This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Hello, and welcome to the Shakti Hour, a podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now network, where I speak with women about their personal experience on the spiritual path. My name is Melanie, and I'm happy to be here with you just following this full moon lunar eclipse weekend. I hope you all got to see the beautiful moon and were able to take in some of the transformative and revealing power of the moon's energy over the weekend. We're towards the end of July here, and at the end of the second book in the Shakti Summer Reading Series. We started off with Lama Siltram's book, Wisdom Rising, moved into Tammy Lynn Kent's two books, Wild Creative and Wild Feminine. And next month, we'll have Roshi Joan Halifax and her book, Standing at the Edge. So go ahead and follow along at the Shakti Hour podcast Instagram or on the Shakti Hour page at Facebook and also Shakti Hour on Twitter. Today, I am sharing with you a conversation with the brilliant Mirabai Bush. And she has a new book coming out with Ram Dass in September called Walking Each Other Home. And it is so special. It's a beautiful conversational book with two great friends, Mirabai and Ram Dass, speaking about transition into death and transition in general. And I highly recommend you check that out when it comes out. This conversation with Mirabai is super cool. I was really happy to have time to talk with her and just get to hear her story about, you know, how she came to spirituality, how she met Ram Dass, what it was like traveling across the Middle East to India and sitting in Bodh Gaya, and when she first encountered Neem Karoli Baba. So I really hope you'll take some time to listen to this chat and learn more about Mirabai's story and look forward to their book coming out in about a month. And we may speak again in December more in depth about the book, because we got a bit carried away just talking about some good stories and some good experiences. So we didn't get too much into their book. So we may get a chance to speak again about that later. I also wanted to let you know that coming up this fall, I'm offering a special Shakti Sacred Music series that I'm super excited about, and we are recording and producing those episodes over the next month, and they'll be coming out in October and November. And if you want to follow along and support that podcast series, you can go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/ShaktiHour, and become a patron from anywhere from a one-time donation to $2 all the way up to $25 or more if you want to sign on and get some special rewards and lead-ins to this sacred music series that's coming out and other reflections and meditations that I'm offering there for subscribers. So please do remember to also subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes and go to the BeHereNowNetwork.com and check out all the other amazing podcasts and offerings there and get caught up on all your Shakti Hour episodes over the summer months. And please enjoy this wonderful chat with the beautiful Mirabai Bush. Thanks so much for listening. So I wanted to just, I know that a lot of the satsang knows a bit of your story, but just for the Shakti Hour, I'd love if you would share with me and the listeners a little bit about, you know, how you came to your practice, how you came to spirituality, what happened for you, how you got here.
Good question. And I'll try to give it a short answer. It was a long process. I grew up as a Catholic girl, went to church every Sunday, and I was in Catholic school from preschool through Georgetown Graduate School, where I studied medieval literature. I felt like, you know, I found my answers that way. And one of the ways that Catholic children were educated then was with the stories of the saints. And so I always wanted to be a saint. I just thought, because there were women who were saints, there weren't, you know, in the Catholic Church, all the priests were men, and pretty much everybody with any kind of significance or power was a man. But in all the universities and so on. But there were saints who were women, and mostly they'd done all forms of sacrifice, which was something that women were supposed to do in those years. But there were also women who did extraordinary things, and my favorite was Joan of Arc. And I love Joan of Arc because she, not because she saved France or wore, you know, a military uniform, but and rode horses, but because she could hear. I always wanted to know what it was I was supposed to be doing on this earth. It's just a yearning to know that. And Joan of Arc heard these voices in her head from God that told her what to do. And then she just did whatever those voices said. And she knew those voices were the truth. They weren't like crazy voices telling her to do weird things. She could tell that that was the truth. She believed it was from God. And he told her, it was a he, I'm sure, to save France. And so she was this young girl, and she did. She organized the French and the French army and saved France. So, and then of course she was a young woman, and there was tremendous resistance to her having this role. And they found a way to convict her of a capital offense, which it turned out Joan of Arc was actually burned at the stake for wearing men's clothes. That was what was on the books.
Gotta find something they can put there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So anyhow, I loved that she did. She heard what she was supposed to do, and she gave herself full-heartedly to it. And it was a spiritual direction. So anyhow, things happened. Early after I graduated from college, I got married to a person who'd been my boyfriend in college, and the person I thought I should marry, he was kind of fit what I thought my family would want me to marry, and so on. And I did. And he was, in those years, men were in ROTC, and when he graduated as an officer, he had a 2-year commitment, and they sent him to Cape Canaveral because he was an aeronautical engineer, and I went with him. And there, women weren't allowed to work. I had nothing to do, and I walked by the beach all day, every day, and just it was the 60s by this time, and I was beginning to question in a different way. and was beginning to see interconnections. Maybe because I'd never really had that much quiet time for myself ever. Anyhow, although I worked, as it turned out, and was the first woman to work on Cape Canaveral, first professional woman to work on Cape Canaveral, I was the first woman to be issued a hard hat and a jumpsuit, and they built a bathroom for me. But it was the Saturn Apollo, the first moon launch. But even that wasn't really enough. And so I decided that I would leave him, and I did. And I went back to graduate school, and got divorced. And in those years, as a Catholic, I was, basically I was excommunicated. And
worse than Joan of Arc, worse than the...
Yeah, it was like being burned at the stake, you know? So that, I mean, it was hard for me to get, but at the same time, it created this big open space for inquiry and discovery. And through those years, so I was in graduate school from 67 to 70, and those were times of huge change. And while I was there, you know, and I was studying literature and poetry, and there were amazing people would visit the campus, and they included like Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg and people like that. And I started doing psychedelics in the last year I was there. I was very involved in anti-war work and civil rights work. I was the head of a program for entering African-American students who were coming really to the university for the first time after Martin Luther King was killed. So all kinds of things were like changing and moving in me. And by 1970, I felt like it was really hard to find a sane way of living. The anti-war movement had created all kinds of chaos on campus, and the police had taken over the campus, as they did at many schools. And it was really difficult to teach, and I just felt like I wanted to find out if there was anybody living on the planet who knew a better way of a more integrated life and a more peaceful life than we were able to live there. So with my then partner, John Bush, we traveled across Europe and the Middle East, and through the former Yugoslavia and Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. And all along the way, people were so good to us. It was a peaceful time in all those countries. And people just took care of us and took us to their mosques and their temples and fed us. And I was beginning to see that there were ways of living that made more sense to me. And I was opening and appreciating all these different ways of being with integrating spiritual awareness into daily life. And then we got to India. And the first day I was in India, I met Sharon Salzberg. We'd been at the same school, but we hadn't known each other there. But we met each other on the street in Delhi. And she told
me that.
Did
you recognize her? Yeah,
well, you know, in those years, there were very few Westerners around. Right. So when we saw each other, we knew there was some connection.
Right.
And then as soon as we started talking, we realized there was a lot of connection. And she told me that there was a meditation course being offered for Westerners for the first time by Goenka, Burmese Buddhist teacher, and he was teaching in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha had been enlightened. and in an old monastery there, and that I could go. And, you know, I had never meditated. I had never done anything like that. And I wasn't, you know, I just thought, well, I'm in India. Seems like might as well learn to meditate. So went there with no expectation and no experience.
With none and, other than Sharon Salzberg, right? Who, yeah.
Yeah. and then I got there and there were, I can't remember now. I think there were maybe 50 or 70 of us. And all these people had heard in kind of similar ways, you know, the word had just traveled. And just walking toward the monastery, it was called the Vihara, House of Stillness. And outside, standing outside, was this person who with a long beard and in all white clothes, like kind of floaty clothes. And I was drawn, and there were several other young guys around him. And I wondered what they looked like. They were talking about something very spiritual and important. And so I went up to them, and it turned out it was Ram Dass. And he was talking, and I can't remember, but it was probably Ramesh and KD Krishnadas. They were trying to decide how many cookies they should buy at the Chaiwala to take into the monastery, because we knew that there wouldn't be anything sweet in there. And we were staying for 10 days. So it was my first experience of Ram Dass. And then we got there and we started, if you know about how Goenka used to run his retreats, they were for 10 days and you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. They were all in silence. There were two meals and you basically started meditating, and you meditated till 10 o'clock at night. And with great instruction. So it wasn't hard to stay there. Well, I would say on the Zafu, except what I had forgotten, but realized years later, recently, someone came up, I think it was Joseph Goldstein, came up with old pictures from that time. And we were, of course, we all looked like hippies. We were, you know, we had long kind of messy hair and, you know, kind of hippie clothes. And we were sitting on the floor, the room, I remembered it, the meditation hall, you know, I remembered it as, you know, pretty vast with Goenka on a little stage. But actually, it was really small. We looked like we were stuffed into somebody's living room. And we were all sitting on the floor, and with our legs crossed, we were so close to each other that, I mean, I don't remember ever like touching any or leaning on anyone while we were sitting, but there must have just been like, you know, the width of a piece of paper between each one of us.
Right.
And there we sat for often without moving. He'd do these hour-long without moving practices for days and days. And we slept on the floor, basically, or if we had little mats. Sharon and I made a little, we hung up some saris and made it kind of a little room out of a big open space. And it was so simple and so wonderful. Just from the, it had never really occurred to me as an intellectual and a New Yorker and a person who was studying literature, the great minds of the past and present, it never occurred to me to look into my own mind and that I would actually learn from that. I mean, I appreciated the workings of my intellectual mind and enjoyed that, but that I could understand the nature of the mind by looking within and watching my breath and noticing the sensations in my body. It was really changed everything. And then, of course, he also taught us metta, loving kindness meditation, that really, I had always had a pretty open heart, but I'd also had a broken heart many times and had a lot of pain in my childhood. My father left and so on. And still pain from having gotten divorced in that first marriage. And just the opening of the heart and the ease and acceptance that our judgment of ourselves and being with all these other people who were doing the same thing and you knew it, it was radical for me. And at the end of the 10 days, we all kind of looked around, said, we don't want to stop. So, I mean, we were happy for a break, but we wanted to do more. And of course, some of the guys were convinced that they were going to become enlightened. So they wanted to do as much meditation as possible so they could get enlightened.
Right, right, yeah.
So then we did another course and then another and another. I think, I forget how many we did. Some of the sitting we did was underneath the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha had been enlightened. Now, of course, there's like a billion tourists around the tree at all times. But then there weren't any. I mean, there were some Japanese pilgrims, but, you know, hardly anybody. And so that was the beginning of the next part of my spiritual journey. And as I said, Ram Dass and KD and Ramesh were there also, and Danny Goleman. So a real core of those of us who later met Maharaji. And then also a core of what became the Buddhist flourishing in this country, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Wes Nisker, and others. And of course, we all got very bonded with each other. And
you know, I just love I love the way that you told that first part. I know there's a big second chapter to this here we're about to jump into, but it's just, I love this, the ease of the flow. And I am sure in the experiencing of it, there was challenges and difficulties and struggles and feelings in depth, but really, you know, just if it was to be a painting, it's such a beautiful painting of this flow of kind of the seed of your being, you know, slowly kind of unraveling and going on this path. I mean, I've had the pleasure now to talk to several of you that were on this journey, and you so nonchalantly, you know, tell this tale of wandering across Europe and the Middle East and landing in India as if, you know, nowadays that would seem unfathomable to, you know, go on such a relaxed journey, and that kind of the openness and the naivete of that exploration, you know, I don't know, fueled by what? I mean, to me, it's so obviously this, you know, these great souls kind of coming together and all deciding to like meet in Bodh Gaya for like a reunion, like a high five here. Oh, let's do this. Let's do this century. Like, yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I look back on it too, you know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, some people, Anasuya, who was with Maharaji, she was 19 when she went over there. I was, at least I had a little life experience, but naive was definitely part of it. Boy, I remember that. So we just had our backpacks, you know, and whatever you could have. So I was wearing a patchwork skirt that I had made because we had, I didn't mention, but we had started a commune in British Columbia in between graduate school and so there, you know, that we cooked over open fires and crocheted and So I made myself this patchwork skirt, and I wore it all across. And then I had, I must have had some jeans also, but, and I had, oh, and I had this one little dress that was made out of something synthetic that rolled up into a little ball in the backpack. And I used it. My idea was that I would use it for going to embassies because I thought it made me look, you know, straight. And, and so I would, I'd wear it to embassies to get my visas for each country. So, so also we finally stopped, you know, we had like two changes of clothes. We finally stopped. We were in Istanbul. And, so I was getting my clothes washed and cleaned. And the only thing I had left was this little dress. And of course, this is the 60s, right? So late 60s. So it had a teeny mini skirt, you know. And I was much younger. I could wear that mini skirt quite well in America. But this was Istanbul. And so I put on the dress. And then I went to get my shoes fit. I guess you could get new soles put on them then. And so I and the shoemaker was like most things in the in a bazaar in those kinds of countries, there's an open front, you know, it's like a storefront, only it's all open. And so and you sat in there while he worked on your shoes. As I remember, the shoes were still on my feet. I was sitting there on this chair in this little mini skirt, and he started working. And before he finished, there were about 200 men had gathered around to watch. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And the police had to come and escort me back to wherever we were staying.
Wow.
That's how naive. And yet, I was never... you know, in Turkey, men used to kind of like grab at you as you were walking past, but, and then they just keep on going. But I was never in any danger with men in the whole way across. I mean, I did have a boyfriend, but of course, lots of times I was by myself. And it was a different time.
Yeah.
I mean, some women did have things happen, but basically, considering two, you know, I don't know how many, 4 months going across and you know, 2 years in India and nothing bad ever happened. No Me Too moment.
Well, so can you tell me a little bit now about what your mind, you mentioned your exploration of your mind kind of as part of this journey, which is really intriguing to me the way you said that you enjoyed the intellectual exploration of your mind, but then through this practice, you came to look at it a different way. Can you tell me about how that has evolved for you? Like that understanding of your mind and.
Mm-hmm. Well, the big discovery, as I'm sure you know, is that you are not your mind. My mind always worked well, like in graduate school, right? So it could make all these connections, and I always liked that. But what I discovered from sitting is that I am not that mind. I am not only that mind. That there is, that I am awareness, that what I discovered is that there was some part of me that could watch that mind and watch it working, and that was not that mind. That there's awareness, which is the deeper part of who we are, but it's bigger part of who we are, but it is that part of who we are that is not limited in the ways that the mind and body are. And just being able to rest in that awareness, to notice my mind, to be able to not judge what was going on in my mind. I felt free from that. I felt free, and I felt, at the same time, I felt more grounded, and like I really was free to be a person on this planet, enjoying it, discovering what it is that I'm here to do, but not be so identified with that mind and my body that I got caught in thinking that that's all there is.
Yeah, you know, because that's something that I have really appreciated about the being a part of this community, is that all the whole mind is held, that the whole thing gets to be held, that the intellect is not abandoned, but that just as you were saying that, as you were describing your experience, it brought me into that experience in my own being, where it's like a balancing out, you know, it's like everything is contained in the same amount of energetic spread through the whole being. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, maybe the major misconception I'm sure you run into all the time about meditation is the shutting down of the mind.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course. This people idea. Always ask me that. Yeah.
How do you get your mind to stop? Exactly. So I guess pulling out the word mind and the way that you were describing your relationship with it. And then also back to the story of Joan of Arc and like her mind receiving messages and that intuitive, you know, hearing something and then putting it into form. But I don't know. I'm just sensing into the way you're telling the story. That's something that's standing out to me is especially, you know, from the perspective of the feminine in the empowerment of the mind, like being educated, you know, being educated and being educated in the in the Catholic system. And this, the icon is a woman who hears voices, right? You know, and that early part of your life, this version of self that you broke out of quickly, thank goodness, you know, continued to grow your mind and then land in this foreign place to sit and have a whole new relationship with it, you know. I'm just flowing through that with you. It's just such a cool part, it feels like, of your story that you were invested in that part of yourself, you know, and in growing that part of yourself, and that finding contemplative practice, finding meditation, gave you even more freedom.
Yeah. Yes. One thing I remember after being silent for so long, I mean, there were like a day or two in between these courses. And of course, we all were talking like crazy. And we all wanted to know about each other because we become intimate with each other by sitting in silence next to each other. But we didn't really know anything about each other's stories. And so we'd like be sharing like mad. And I remember Ram Dass was like, you've got to be in the moment. So he would call us the used to be's because we were always talking about who we used to be. But after all this time, I thought, because I've been so invested in language and ideas before that. I said to Ram Dass, you know, What do you say? How do you talk after being silent for so long?
It's a great question. Yeah.
And we've seen things in such a different way. And he said, it's easy. He said, you just say what you know and you don't say what you don't know. And I thought, I might never talk again. Because I was so aware about the limitations of what I thought I knew, you know. But that was a big part of, like, it's finally a search for the truth, right? And we want to, when we speak, we want to contribute to that. Which was part of what was so wonderful about being with Maharaji was that, as you know, he spoke very little. And he would just say these simple things that we could then keep, like, deconstructing over and over again through these 45 years of, like, what does it really mean to love everyone, serve everyone, you know, always tell the truth. Yeah. So
I love this also that, so you sat in Bodh Gaya for many weeks before you met Maharaj.
For me, that was really important because, well, what happened was this was Ram Dass's second trip to India. And in between the two trips was when he wrote Be Here Now. And it came out while we were there. And one copy was sent to the monastery. And it was when it was still in a box. And pretty much, I mean, I was one of the last people to get to see it. And because there were people who had known Ram Dass and before going to India and so on. So I was kind of not that important in the hierarchy. So we were a group of us left on a bus. You've probably heard the story. And we were going to meet Swami Muktananda in Delhi to do an all-night Shiva chant for Shivaratri. As we were going through Allahabad, one of the places on the way, and Ram Dass, of course, had written in Be Here Now about there's no point in ever trying to find Maharaji because your guru finds you and he moves around all the time and there's just appreciate that he exists, but you don't have to be with him. So, and I had just, Goenka had been firm about, of course, at that time in India, there were all kinds of gurus and most families had a guru and many of them weren't really that good at helping people advance spiritually. So he and this is the Southern Buddhist message anyhow, you don't need a guru. All you need is what's sometimes called a spiritual friend or teacher who is a little ahead of you on the path and can teach you the practice, because everything will be revealed through the practice. And it certainly seemed that way after practicing for those months. It seemed like I was learning so much, and I didn't feel like I did. I needed a teacher to teach me how to do it and to answer questions, but I didn't feel like I needed a guru. I didn't, and of course, in the West, so it never occurred to me that I would want a guru. So we were driving through Allahabad, we were passing a Hanuman temple, and Ramesh, I think, looked out the window and said, there's Maharaji.
No.
The bus came to a screeching halt, and everybody piled out of the bus. And it was, each in their own way, had amazing experiences. And I was one of the last out. And I had just read the part in Be Here Now about Maharaji. And I was looking at his picture and having these thoughts about, you know, how amazing what that such a being could exist But, you know, I don't need to meet him. It's great that Ramdas did. And then there he was. And so I was one of the last. And I kind of walked down the stairs of the bus and I looked at him. And in one look, I got that all these tiny openings that I'd had, these glimpses of truth, glimpses of the way things are, glimpses of how much more there was than I had ever guessed to being in this mind and body and awareness. And I looked at Maharaji, and in that moment, he seemed, and I think was, the embodiment of the fulfillment of all those things I had had tiny glimpses of. Mm. He was just fully there. And he just beamed love. It was amazing. It was just, I took one look at him, and I never thought I'd bow to a teacher. And I was full down on the ground. And I don't know, you know, it was so, seemed so unlikely. And it was so real. And I got up and looked at him and felt that love that he was able to give us. And then, you know, as we say, the rest is history. My life changed in that moment. And then we went to, then there's that story that he had told the family he was staying with that he was bringing 18 people for lunch, and there were 18 of us, and we got there and they were ready for us and they served us this fabulous lunch. And he was, the devotee was, the daughter was a economics professor at University of Allahabad. And so, you know,
so this is again this, so you had this you went on this beautiful painting of this first chapter. Then you have this deep study of the mind, basically, in your meditation courses. So then what was your relationship to your mind in that moment? Did you?
I don't remember. I think in that moment, I was, it was as the Zen folks say, no mind, you know, a heart. If there was mind, it was this realization that as humans, we can be so much more than I had ever glimpsed, ever even thought of. And that possibility just, you know, even, I mean, I had the great, you know, privilege of being with Maharaji a lot after that. But, you know, if I hadn't been, just knowing that that's possible completely changed everything for me.
And did it make it aspirational, or did it feel just that it is, it's part of this no mind, it just is? Was it awe and wonder, like you would look at like the Grand Canyon, or, you know?
Yeah, it's like looking at the Grand Canyon after, you know, living in the city, you know. Oh my God, who knew?
Yeah.
But that's a really good one. It just, I knew then that I didn't know. And that made, it opened up such possibilities. So whatever I did after that, I mean, I was inspired to really listen deeply for what it is I was supposed to be doing at each stage. But also I knew that, you know, I could project forward, oh, I'm going to do this and this is going to be the outcome. But I knew that I didn't really know. I didn't know what could come of it, whatever it was.
And I think that honestly, now that you're sharing that, if there's anything to be envious of in those that actually got to meet Maharaji in person is that that knowing that you didn't know, that complete yanking out of the rug,
yeah,
that experience, I was saying that's the growth edge of my sadhana in my relationship with Maharaji. That's the working of my mind that, you know, I have experience after experience of understanding that, but it's a coming to versus a like, now I'm maybe, you know, other people have that experience too with him, you know, out of body, but I feel like what you just described of that coming off the bus moment. You know, is something profound.
Yeah.
You know? And there's so much gratitude for the sharing of the story and the, you know, because I get the transmission of that feeling too, just in your sharing of it. And,
you know, that not knowing is so important. I was recently in a conversation with someone who's more fundamentalist. And that's kind of the definition, because of fundamentalism, that I know what I know. And I know what's right, I know what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I know who's right and who's wrong. And there's no changing that, you know, which is different from being in touch with the truth. Of course, the truth is always emerging. It's not, but it's not to say that some things aren't right and wrong, but there is that being fixed in the thinking that the way you see it is the way, and there's no possibility for inquiry there. So that's the great gift, is having that understanding that you don't know. And yet you listen for, you listen for those directions of, and grounded in what you know so far to be true. So it's, it's complex and simple.
Yeah. So I want to just switch gears a little bit to your new book with Ram Dass that's going to be out this fall. For the listeners, there's a book called Walking Each Other Home, Conversations on Love and Dying that Ram Dass and Mirabai have been working on and are going to share with us all this fall. But I really actually wanted to just dive into this, the very first sentence of the introduction that you wrote. This is a book about loving and dying and friendship. Can you tell me about that?
Well,
because, you know, it's that, like, to me, that's the sentence kind of the whole flow of that story, you know, that with the knees touching in the room in Bodh Gaya.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll tell you that one day I was in Maui visiting Ram Dass, and he said, kind of out of the blue, he said, "I want you to write my last book with me." We had written a book together before years ago. He said, "I want you to write my last book with me," and I said, "Of course, you know, my life is completely full, and I had no idea what the book was going to be about, or, you know, how long it would take." I said, "Of course." And then I said, "What's it about?" And he said, "It's about dying." And then he said, "This time we have a real deadline." I said, "Okay." And that was true at many levels. So then he, you know, expressed that he wanted to, although he's been talking about dying since Be Here Now, it's all there, even in that first book and in the talks he gave before that. I mean, the actual truth of it is there. Yeah. But of course, when you lead a life, you live into those truths that you know at a certain level, at a certain point. And that's what he's been doing all this time. And of course, having gone through the stroke 20 years ago, he had to start looking more closely at what it means to die, or to almost die, or to lose so much. And so he said, you know, there are things I want to say about dying now, but as you know, he has aphasia, and so he can't do it by way of, you know, a like clearly articulated, spontaneous lecture like he used to.
Right.
He said, I want to write it together. I want your voice too. And I thought, this is why I said, of course, right away, because I believe in I have experienced the way in which understanding truth can come forward out of dialogue among friends. If you're sitting with someone you really trust, and you're talking about the things that really matter to you. Even right now, not even right now, but that's what these podcasts are about, you know? Mm. They're dialogues, they're conversations, and understandings come forward that, and sharing comes forward that wouldn't have if there wasn't another person you're talking to. Right. And I do believe that, in particular, that women's wisdom has traditionally come forward that way, and much of it. And that's what's required for, you know, a conversation that's resting in what matters in the truth is friendship, you know, and a spiritual friendship in the sense that, you know, you might disagree on lots of things about in the rest of your life, what you like to do, who your friends are, whatever. But that together you are trying to, you know, discover the meaning of us being here, meaning of being human, for us, the what it was that Maharaj was actually saying to us when he said these short phrases. What's the best way to live out that truth? And of course we were talking about dying, but as Ramana would say, if you want to learn how to die, you have to learn how to live. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing you need to learn about living is how to be more loving, how to become love. And of course, love is at the heart of friendship. So it is all intertwined.
Is there some reason? Yeah, that's beautiful. Is there some reason that you were the friend that he wanted to reflect this with? I like that you're saying that through conversation and in that reflection of the other is part of how we draw out truth. I mean, that's kind of bhakti yoga in essence too, right? And the loving of the other, seeing mm-hmm. God in the other. Is there some reason why, what was the
I don't
piece
know
of your friendship except that drew that out? Yeah.
Except we trust each other. We've been through a lot together. And so it's not a superficial relationship. He knows that I utterly trust him, and he trusts me. And we also have a good time together. We like sitting around and talking and laughing. And we know that we both believe that this is an important book to get out there. We had, in the last few years, been through the deaths of, you know, several close friends and had talked about that. I'd written a little about it and read that to him before I knew he was interested in writing a book. I mean, he could have done it with a number of other people. He has a number of close, you know, trusting relationships. But I don't know, maybe because I was just there. As we say, we don't know.
Right. It's the mystery. But to highlight your willingness to say yes to that and engage, and that's part of that, the love and the friendship part and the dying part. And last year in Maui in May, I wrote down in my notebook during the retreat, Ram Dass said, dying and sadhana are the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've been working with that for some time. Yeah. And yeah. I do know when I was on private retreat with him in 2015, and he was in the hospital during that time. And at that time, my father turned 70, and I sent my father a copy of the book Still Here. And I was with Ram Dass during my father's birthday, and I told him I had sent him that book, and Ram Dass was like, I wrote that book when I was a young person, you know, pre-stroke. He's like, I have a lot of other things to say about that now. So yeah, I guess this was in the works then, but.
Yeah. I learned so much about dying from doing this. We did the book by just sitting in his room day after day. I mean, I went back and forth to Maui, and each time I'd go, we'd sit in his room maybe, you know, half a dozen times and have these conversations, and then I'd take them home and put them in a written form. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I had done lots of practice, and I'm also, well, I always said, I'm getting old. But my partner said, well, I got off the plane one time and he was driving me home, and I said, I'm so tired. You know, I don't know if I can keep on doing all these trips. I'm really getting old. And EJ said, Mirabai, you are not getting old. You are old. That's a great moment. I realize there's been a little denial there. So anyhow, but I, of course, you know, I hadn't done all the work around you know, being free with dying. And so as we began these talks, it wasn't just a process of gathering information to put into a book for either of us, that by being so, you know, I don't know, bringing death into the center of the conversation and into the room with this commitment to explore everything we know and don't know about it, it took us both through pretty many changes about it. Mm. And because with Ram Dass, we got down to the level of, you know, how, where he wants to be when he's dying, who he wants to be around, where he wants his ashes to go. So, you know, brought up lots of, it was good. It was a good process because it wasn't, that's why I know that, you know, it's good for people to bring awareness of death into their lives so that you can begin to kind of let go of your fear, bring your fear close to you and let it go. See what's in there. See if you have, you know, regrets or, you know, things you haven't forgiven or just terror around losing your body and your mind, all of it, you know. It's so good to let go of it, before you have to die, because it makes your life so much lighter and you're just like more open to whatever comes, letting go of that. You know, of course, you're helping yourself be healthy and strong all the time, but you're letting go of that like guard of fear, you know, that something might happen and you'll die. You know, you're just braver in leading your life.
Mm. I love that. Yeah, being brave in meeting your life. And that isn't really relevant to age.
Exactly.
Well, also, honestly, I want to go deeper into the book, but I kind of want to do that at a separate time because I feel like we got through a lot here, and that's just like a little teaser. And since this is coming out in the fall, maybe you and I can talk again in the fall, and we can speak more in depth on the contents of that, of the book. But I wanted to just like connect with you and bring you into the podcast and introduce you to people that are listening, and you know, give a little depth of the story and selfishly connect with you myself one on one to be with you and know more of your tale. And I just love I love the whole thing, and I love that this chapter right now is coming with this book and your collaboration with the mind and with the intellect and with the word and the writing and the sharing of that out, you know, with the teacher, with the spiritual friend, just a step ahead, you know, like you said. So I'll offer you the question that I ask all of the guests, which is, if you had a specific piece of advice to offer women and girls on the spiritual path, you know, having walked this journey, like you said, in a different time, you know, and then coming around to this moment and.
Mm-hmm. I think when I look back, I think the most important thing is to learn to trust yourself. And to do that, you need to give yourself time, take care of yourself, so that you can hear what's being called, what's being asked from within. But trust yourself. I think that, you know, culturally, it's been, there have been a lot of factors that have led to women not always fully trusting themselves. I know that it's key. And trust yourself and take your place wherever you are in a loving, open way, knowing that you don't know everything, but being there in a loving way will, you know, will help you hear what it is that you're supposed to be doing and knowing and how to go forward, and then trust that. Yeah, I think.
That sounds lovely. I love that, the feeling of the calling, being able to trust yourself.
Help women younger than you are.
And help women younger than you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes women older than you are.
Well, I think that it was a lovely introduction, and I really got so much from hearing you tell your experience, and I'm so appreciative of your continued commitment to sharing what you learned and sharing your own personal transformation. And being present to all of us that are behind you on the path.
Great. So, well, I loved it. I love doing this with you, and I'll be happy to do another one later.
Fantastic.
It's really fun. I mean, I got in late last night and I thought, oh God, I'm just going to be so sleepy and dopey tomorrow. And maybe that's been true, but I've enjoyed it.
No, it was really good, Mirabai, and I really, really enjoyed it too. And so, yeah, we'll plan to do it again.
Okay, great.
In the fall, and we'll get this out. And because I did, I mean, because the book is great. So I definitely want to dig into that deeper, but I feel like this was important too. And I just can't wait to get to spend time with you in person and connect more deeply.
Are you going to be at the winter retreat?
I plan to be, yeah.
Good. Yeah. I'll be there.
So we'll do that. And okay. Otherwise, I'll stay in touch with you here.
Yeah, or we could see each other in New York sometime.
Oh, yeah. Let's stay in touch then, too. Yeah, I'll be around here.
Good. Okay.
All right. So much love to you, Mirabai. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you get some rest in before you jump on the plane again.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Have a great day.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.